Matthew 21, no, Matthew 24. More elaborate introduction. When you have a split sermon, in theory, you're supposed to have compressed things. So I compress the introduction by tossing it. Matthew 24, and we're well familiar with this particular chapter. It discusses the end time. And so I'd like us to start in verse 1. Thank you. Appreciate that. I'll take a drink now. I can tell my amusing story that David Keller's told me one time about water and why Indians drank a lot of it before they needed to get up early the next morning to go hunting and what have you. We'll save that for another time. I told that story once. Pentecost, when we met in Lebanon, got to be 10 years ago, anyway, maybe 15, who knows. But anyway, Matthew 24, verse 1. And this begins to describe or give a background to what Christ is going to say throughout this chapter. It says, as Jesus was leaving the temple grounds, his disciples pointed to him various temple buildings. And for those who've read about the temple at that time, built by King Herod, it was quite a sight. I mean, it was beautiful, and it was world-renowned for its beauty. Probably pale in significance as to the first temple that Solomon built, David designed. But still, in that day and time, it was an architectural masterpiece to behold. And they were being, I'll put this in simple Southern terms, it seemed like the disciples were a lot of country boys. And they had come to the big city, and wow, you know, as you look around, because tiny villages like Bethlehem, Nazareth, Capernaum, you know, the towns of Galilee were nothing in comparison to the big city of Jerusalem and the beauty of the structures to be found in that city. And Jesus said unto them in verse 2, do you see not all these things? You know, look around. He says, yeah, I do. This is something to behold. But then he tells them, assuredly I say to you, not one stone shall be left here upon another, and they shall all be thrown down. And we know through history that this did occur in 70 AD. All that is left of those structures are a foundation, but all the stones of the structures themselves have been thrown down. In verse 3, it says, and now he sat on the Mount of Olives, and the disciples came to him privately, and they asked him a question. Because what they heard Christ say, tearing that temple down, tearing those beautiful buildings down, it bothered them. You know, when's this going to happen? And he said, tell us when these things will be. And then it says, and what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age? This episode or period in Christ and the disciples' life was also recorded in Mark 13, Mark 21, each a little different, but virtually the same. And then in verse 4, he begins to answer. And I will assure you, we will not read everything. So you can take a sigh of relief. Somebody just mouthed good. You can see up here, even if I do wear glasses. Anyway, it says, Jesus answered and said to them, take heed, listen, that no one deceives you. It says, for many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and will deceive many. And then beginning in verse 6 down through 31, it gives a list of things to watch for. And as it continues and that list is completed, it begins to tell us the things that are going to happen. the short form, not so much as we find in Revelation, but the gist of it, right up until the second coming of Jesus Christ. And then, in verse 32, Christ stops, and he tells his disciples, and because it's recorded for us today, he's telling us to take note. Verse 32, it says, "Now learn this parable from the fig tree. When the branch has already become tender and put forth leaves, you know that summer is coming." And living where we live, and we have four seasons, unlike some parts of the world, be they north and have only one season, and be they south and they only have one season. But we here get to see the summer coming. And where we live, usually sometime in February. So, now that's never happened to me before. I usually leave this thing in the car. I don't know who it is, I don't know what it is, I'm going to turn it off, and I apologize. This is when I usually leave in the car. Okay, whatever. Hey, enjoy it. If you can't laugh at me as I laugh at myself, whatever. Life would not be good. But, like I said, where we live, actually we live on, I think most of you have a good idea where it's called Burnt Knob Road. And on our side of the knob, which is the north side, the daffodils come out, usually toward the end of February 1st of March. And on the south side of the knob, they usually come out. And you can tell it's getting spring because it comes out on the south side first, which makes my wife happy because she knows that in a week or so, the daffodils are going to come out in our pasture and on our side of the knob. And so we you know, that's what Christ said. You know, you look at the things around you, and you'll be able to see what's about to happen. And, you know, we see the daffodils pop on the south side of the knob as we come to church. And my wife knows, a couple weeks, they'll be out in my pasture. And my, actually, daughter and now my granddaughter would there was a time they relished because they would go out and pick the daffodils and make bouquets for their mother and their grandmother. And I can remember one year it snowed, and so I'm out there with a flashlight in the middle of the night. Felt like the middle of the night. Dusting snow off, and Tori's picking the daffodils. So we ended up with this huge bunch. So I think that's when we had our 8 or 10 inch snow with drifts of 5 or 6 feet. I know Jason and Noreen and that group probably says, "Really? That happened here once in the 30 years that we've lived here." So if you're here 30 years, you may see the same thing once. Not like where you're from and grew up. Anyway, but you know, Christ tells us, you know, there are signs. Pay attention, and you'll know that the end is near. Verse 33, it says, So you also, when you see all these things, know that it, speaking of the end time, is near. It's at the door. It says, "Assuredly I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place." And I think we understand that this generation did not mean the disciples, but this generation meant those who saw these signs coming to pass. Those who saw the total picture of that which we could have read in the verses after 6 and down through 31, that generation would not pass away until it would come. And it says, "Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words by no means will pass." So this is going to happen. There's not a thing that you can do about it. It's going to happen. And then it reads in verse 36, "But as of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, only my Father." And then verse 37, let's read. It says, "But as in the days of Noah were, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be." So I would ask the question of us this morning as we begin to get more into the heart of this message. What was it like in the days of Noah? So let's start at Genesis 6, where the part of the story of Noah is recounted. Genesis 6, we'll begin in verse 1. It said, "Now it came to pass, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw the daughters of men, and they were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves of all whom they chose. And the Lord said, My spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he is indeed flesh, and yet his days shall be 120 years. So God begins to, or written by Moses, that as God looked down on the earth, he said, you know, mankind's going to last 120 more years, and then something is going to happen, because I'm tired of this. And as we read further, it says, verse 5, it says, "Then the Lord saw the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and every intent of the thoughts of his heart were only evil continually." Verse 6, it said, "The Lord was sorry. He was grieved that he had made man on the earth." It says it grieved his heart. "And so the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping things, birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them." And then it tells us, "But Noah, one man, found grace in the eyes of the Lord." And we know that God told Noah to build an ark. He gave him instruction as to what to take with him. He gave him instruction that his wife and sons should go with him, and they would, you know, be protected, and they would be the seeds of a new civilization. Not a new creation, but a new civilization, a new creation of society, I guess you might say. And then in verse 11, it begins to again describe some more about the earth and the times of Noah. It says, "The earth was also corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence." And in verse 12, it reiterates, or begins and then reiterates, these two concepts, these two words, corrupt and violence. It says, "So God looked on the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. And God said to Noah, The end of flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them. And behold, I will destroy them with the whole earth." So God was going to not only destroy the earth as Noah knew it, but he was going to destroy the society. He was going to destroy mankind. Let's look at those two words, corrupt and violence. And we'll use the less scholarly but easily accessible Strong's Concordance. The word corrupt, and I'll spell it. It's going to be spelled. Y'all got Strong, so y'all look it up. Look up corrupt, you'll find it. But it's pronounced, as I can pronounce it, Shakath. And as it talks or explains the definition of Shakath, which is translated corrupt, it says to decay. That is, to costly ruin. Literally or figuratively, it says to batter, to destroy, to lose, to mar, perish, spoil, and utterly waste. Think about the word corrupt. It says the earth was corrupt. And we look at the world around us, you might say the ecology. If I'm wrong, tell me later. But the earth is decaying. You know, we, depending on your who you believe and your politics and this, that, and the other thing, we are told that we have, you know, polar ice caps melting We are told of the pollution that mars our environments, be it the waters of rivers and streams and lakes, be it the, you know, places where, you know, people have to clean up sites where there have been oil spills or where things have been stored back in the day when there was no thought to the long-term damage that might occur to God's earth. You know, man did not take seriously God's instruction to keep and dress his creation. We use it up and we spit it out and we move on to the next place. And over the centuries we've strip mined and clear cut and we've learned things and we've instituted them, but it's more to keep the cycle going. I don't think it's so much to keep and dress God's creation. I think it's just to keep our wants and desires. It's fueled by our wants and desires to have the things that mining, what have you, allow us to have. But it's, you know, this world, if you think about it, is in a state of decay. And it's being spoiled. It's being ruined. And that's what Christ said that it would be like in the end times, just like Noah. Now, how they corrupted the earth, have no idea. It's a question we can ask one day. But we know how we're doing it. The next word to look at is violence. Violence is, when we say violence, we have thoughts that come quickly to mind. In Strong's, the word that is translated there in Matthew is kamasi, and it says violence, by implication wrong, unjust gain, cruelty, damage, false, injustice, oppressor, unrighteous, violence against, violence done, violent dealings, and then lastly, I'm adding a couple words, just plain wrong. So if you think about violence in those terms, not just, we might say, in a physical confrontation, fist fight, guns, what have you, violence is when it says the earth was filled with violence in the days of Noah, it's also telling us that earth will be filled with violence before Christ comes. We'll ask the question, does this describe the society, the nation, and the world in which we live? Is the society, the nation, and the world we live, is it violent? I randomly typed in the word violence. Bing, not Google. I have close ties to Microsoft. So I go Bing. Hey, you gotta watch out for the brand. That's why I don't have an iPhone. When I change phones, I'm gonna get a Windows phone. You know, I have been castigated for not having the latest and greatest iPhone. Anyway, but randomly typed in the word violence. It's like anything, you type in a word and you get a myriad of choices. So I picked one, had no idea what it was. I chose one for this particular purpose. And it's was actually found on a government website for Newfoundland and Labrador, which I've heard of Newfoundland. I didn't know that it was a longer name, being the eastern province, or being the most eastern province of Canada. But part, somewhere in the myriad of things on this webpage, was something that addressed violence. And on this part of it, it defined and listed types of violence and abuse. And it was kind of like, okay. I can see that. We'll run down the list and run through the definition, and you can take it as you will, either agree or disagree. It says, violence and abuse are best understood as a pattern behavior of intended to establish power and maintain control. Now, in this particular case, they were talking more familial violence, in particular, violence as it related to women, or toward women, actually. But I think we can look at it and get a broader view of society, because I feel that it still applies. It says, the roots of all forms of violence or abuse are found in the many types of inequality which continue to exist and grow in our society. And then it has a list, and I'll leave you to think about these types or what they classify in violence. And again, does this describe the society, the nation, and the world in which I live? It says physical violence. You know, is our world full of physical violence? And then it says sexual violence. Does our world have a great amount of sexual violence? Emotional violence. Again, is there a great amount of emotional violence or abuse in the world in which we live? Spiritual violence. You know, you can ask, again, the same question. Cultural violence. You know, culturally, are some societies violent? Or do cultures clash and in turn call violence? I think we can agree. I hope so. A lot of times that's when somebody says, you know, reasonable people can agree on this. Well, if you disagree, automatically you're unreasonable. It's a trap. You don't have to fall for it. You can say, I'm reasonable, I don't agree. But anyway, but I think you might agree. Verbal abuse. People are angry. You know, how often do we hear, particularly if you're in a service industry, and people just go off at the smallest thing, or even, I mean, you know, you get a phone call or even make a phone call, and you know, you are automatically, if you're, say, in the service industry, you're going to get an aggressive behavior with the person right off the bat. Or, you know, you may have been the last straw, and you may be in aggressive mode when you make a phone call. But verbal abuse, financial violence or abuse, you know, we can look at that. Russell mentioned the debt that this nation has. Is that not abusing not only our generation, our nation, our citizens, but the generations to come? And then neglect. You know, is there neglect in the world? Again, I think those are, and not just is there neglect, does it describe, is it pervasive in the world in which we find ourselves? Have these types of behavior, described or defined as violence, become more prevalent in the society, the nation, and the world in which we live during our lifetime? Russell pointed out, I did the math 58 years, not 50. So, anybody older, younger than 58, not supposed to have point of reference, but you do. Anyway, so, you know, has the world been you, we'll say, 11, 12 years old, because you're aware of things that have changed over the course of your lifetime? Or be you, is it 82? Definitely, Mr. Fritz, they're about 82, 83, somewhere in there. Has the world changed? Not just changed, but change markedly. Has violent behavior, as we define in the list, become more prevalent in your lifetime? Again, BU 11 or 12, has violence become more prevalent in your lifetime? Or BU in your 80s, has life become more violent, has the earth become more violent during the time in which you've lived? It's a good question for us to ask ourselves as we think about, so as in the days of Noah. Let's turn to Luke 17. And this is not the same incident, but the same description. The same words are used. Luke 17 will begin in verse 26. Verse 26, it says, "As it was in the days of Noah, so shall it also be in the days of the Son of Man." And then in verse 28, it says, "Likewise, as it was in the days of Lot." So the question could be asked, what was Sodom like during Lot's time? Now we think of the perverse sexual practices, and that quickly comes to mind. But let's turn to Ezekiel 16, because there was more wrong with Sodom than just perverse sexual practices. Ezekiel 16, we'll begin in verse 48. It says, "As I live, says the Lord God, neither your sister Sodom nor her daughters have done as you and your daughters have done. Look, this was the iniquity of your sister Sodom, she and her daughters." And then it recounts the sins, the things that were wrong with Sodom. There are six, as I'm able to count them. The first one, she and her daughters had pride. So I ask the question again, does this describe the world in which we live? Does this describe the nation in which we live? Does this describe the society, be it world or be it national societies in which we live? She and her daughters had abundance. Does this, again, the questions could be asked, does this describe the world society in which we live? She and her sisters had, the third thing, abundance of idleness. Now, I know many of us here, maybe I shouldn't use less, many of you here have anything but idleness. You work long hours. But as a society, is there an abundance, a world society, is there abundance of idleness? So if you think about abundance of idleness, and you think about those old sayings, you know, was it idle hands or idle mind is the devil's workshop? I forget exactly how it goes. You know, if we look back and we think about violence, there's got to be a lot of idle time, because there's a lot out there that is not godly. And then it's speaking of Sodom. It says, she and her daughters, fourth thing, neither strengthened the hand of the poor and needy. In some instances, I think here in America, we've done a good job over the years. But let's think globally. Let's think pervasively. Can it be said that the hand of the needy and the poor is not strengthened? Again, that's a question for you to answer, not for me. I have my opinion. I think it's pretty obvious what it is, but still, it's a question for each one of us to answer. And in verse 50, it gives the fifth thing she and her sisters had, talking about their iniquities. It says, and they were haughty. Is the world, the society, the nation in which we live, haughty? Or the people haughty? Again, you answer the question. And the sixth thing, they committed abomination before the Lord. Can that be said as pervasive? Can that be said to describe the society, the nation, and the world in which we live? Now let's turn back to Luke 17 and finish the thought about the times of Noah and Lot. Verse 26, we'll retread the beginning. It says, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be in the days of the Son of Man. And then it talks about the times of Noah, but it's a little different than we've read and looked at in the past. It says, they ate, they drank, they buried wives, they were given in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark, and the flood came and destroyed them all. Let's take a minute, and you can, I'll just give you the gist, but 1 Peter 2:5 and Hebrews 11:7, as I read and understand them, and you may or may not, same way. It says one, 2 Peter 2, that Noah was a preacher of righteousness. And we know he had 120 years from the time that God gave him instruction till the flood came. And in Hebrews 11, it talks about the ark was a warning to mankind of the coming destruction. So it would indicate to me that Noah told people what was coming. And as the flood came, and as we read God's word, only 8 people and a bunch of animals walked up that ramp. I'm assuming it was a ramp, that's what you see in movies. You know, walked up that ramp into the ark, the door closed, the rains came, and the flood occurred. This preaching didn't have a lot of effect. The earth, just like God had said, was destroyed. Mankind, except for those 8 souls, were obliterated. And then in verse 28, it says, likewise also in the days of Lot, and we read what the society around Lot was like. And again it says, they ate, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, and they built. But on the day that Lot went out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. I know all of us sometimes look at verses and we look at what other people have to say. And I found some information in a couple of places. I think most of us have access to these too. And I haven't quoted it word for word, but I think this is accurately the gist of it. The Life Application Study Bible said life was going on just as usual. Most people were going about their everyday tasks completely indifferent to God. Again, would that describe the society and the world in which we live? You know, as they say, Nero fiddled, while Rome burned? Does society just go about their business and ignore the violence and corruption of this earth? You know, the wrongs, the sins. James Fawcett Brown puts it similar to this. It says, all the enjoyments of life, though the antediluvian world and the cities were awfully wicked, it was not their wickedness, but their worldliness, their unbelief, and their indifference and unpreparedness that is held up as a warning. You know, these two scriptures, it says they ate, they drank, they built, they married, they gave in marriage. You know, they were just, life goes on. There was no outrage. There was no great outrage. It's not enough to change things. These two societies did not recognize the violence and corruption that surrounded and encompassed them. Our world society will find itself in the same condition as in the times of Lot and Noah. No, this is my feeling. Again, you can agree or disagree. But I think today we find the people of this world society go on with their lives. They plant, they build, they buy, they eat, they drink, they marry, and are indifferent to God and are oblivious to the corruption and violence which surrounds and engulfs them. But God also, as I believe Russell read a little earlier, gave a cautionary warning, not only to the world, but to those of us sitting here today. Let's turn to Luke 21. Verse 34. Luke 21, verse 34. We'll read down through verse 36. It says, but take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing, drunkenness, cares of this life, eating, drinking, building, buying, marrying, giving in marriage. Not that those things in and of themselves are wrong. They're not. When we look at blessings, as Russell alluded to in his sermon in Deuteronomy, we look at blessings, and those blessings include eating and drinking and marrying and giving marriage. Those could be blessings. But it says, take heed that you're not weighed down with these things, the cares of life, that the day comes on you unexpectedly. It says, for it will become a snare on all those who dwell on the face of the earth. Doesn't say it becomes a snare for the other guys. It says it will become a snare for all those who dwell on the face of the earth. And then it gives this warning, as we read earlier, heard earlier. Watch and pray that you may be counted worthy to escape these things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. It gives us instruction on how we can hopefully, or no, how we can avoid the snare of becoming overly fixated on the cares of this life and ignoring the corruption and violence that will fill this earth. But we also, God, when he gives warnings, he also gives instructions and gives encouragement on things that will happen and how he will save ultimately. So let's turn to 2 Peter 2 as we close. 2 Peter 2. We'll begin in verse 5. We'll go down through verse 9. Verse 5, it says, "And God did not spare the ancient world. He warned them through Noah." It said, "Except for Noah and the seven others in his family, God warned the world." Noah warned the world of God's righteous judgment. He told them what was going to happen. So God protected Noah when he destroyed the world of ungodly people with a vast flood. And then it says, later, God condemned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah and turned them into heaps of ashes. He made them an example of what will happen to ungodly people for those who ate, who drank, who built, who planted, who bought, who married, gave in marriage, as the world around them fell apart in corruption and violence. And then it says in verse 7, "But God rescued Lot out of Sodom because he was a righteous man who was sick of the shameful immorality of the wicked people around him." Gives an idea of how we should feel about the wickedness and the corruption that surround us. In verse 8 it says, "Yes, Lot was a righteous man who was tormented in his soul by the wickedness he saw day after day." In verse 9, this is where we can take heart. We can take encouragement. "So you see that the Lord knows how to rescue godly people from their trials, even while keeping the wicked under punishment until the day of the final judgment." So it's the saying here that as society pulls and tugs at each of us, and as Satan wants his world society to surround and engulf those of us in the body of Christ, you and I, you and me, poor English, but hey, I'm a Southerner, might as well fit the stereotype, but you and me can take heart and encouragement to know that God knows how to rescue godly people.